sales win rates have plummeted to a mere 17%, and outdated technology and tedious manual processes are to blame. Meanwhile, managers lack the visibility they need to hold their teams accountable. But imagine a world in which these crippling issues are solved automatically. Revenue.io automates the most frustrating parts of sales so reps can focus on what they do best, selling. Completely automate pre-call research, logging conversation data in your CRM, writing post-conversation recap emails, and prioritized outreach. And as reps book more meetings and close more deals, managers gain the real-time insight they need to scale what's working across their entire team. Ready to say goodbye to tedious sales processes and watch your win rate soar? Head over to revenue.io to learn more.
I can't relate to the people that don't do whatever it takes, but like, we do whatever it takes to develop all the training, the coaching, the learning, the education. And it could be why we've been able to grow so fast, but I feel bad for anyone at a company that would have not done that. Like, as a CEO and a salesperson, I couldn't imagine like being in an environment, when I sold for IBM and a resource, like this is how they were. It was nothing. I'm giving you nothing. You're here, go make millions of dollars in sales. And I hated that. So I think I've been in the bad and the good, and that's why I built everything that we've built.
Hi, friends. Welcome to the Sales Enablement Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Paul. That was Brandon Bernanson. He's the CEO at Seamless.ai. And today we have a wide-ranging conversation about some of the most pressing challenges facing sellers coming up in 2021 and beyond. We talk about which of the changes we've seen in the past 12 months will become permanent and what impacts these changes will have on the skills that sellers will need in order to perform at higher levels. We also explore the whole notion of modern selling. Is it actually modern, or are B2B sales stuck in the past in some very fundamental ways? And Brandon and I also dive into one of my favorite topics, is how to improve individual sales productivity. So lots of great practical takeaways today. Before we get to Brandon, I want to remind you to subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen to it. And if you subscribe, we'd certainly appreciate it if you could also give us your feedback about how we're doing in the form of a review. So thank you. All right, let's jump into it. Brandon, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Andy. Appreciate it. Big fan.
Well, thank you. Well, we've never had a chance to meet before. Sort of surprising. I guess maybe if all the conferences hadn't shut down the last year and a half, we might have been able to do that.
I know. It is a little odd, but hey, glad we're connected. You know, that's the great part about LinkedIn, man. You can meet anyone, anywhere, anytime now.
Yeah. Well, increasingly so, right? I mean, I remember I was telling somebody when I started this podcast 5 years ago, or a little over five, almost 5.5 years ago now. Wow. And I'd ask the guests, tell people how they can get in touch with you. So everybody defaulted to email first. But that's the way it was then, right?
Yeah.
And now it's LinkedIn. No one gives an email.
No.
You can give an email.
I barely check my email now. I don't have time to check my email. So it's, it's good.
Yeah. My LinkedIn inbox is, busier than my email at this point. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. They're both similar. It's crazy.
All right. So for people who aren't familiar with Seamless.ai, tell us what you do.
Sweet. So, again, thanks for having me. Seamless finds direct dials and emails for any professional in the world in seconds. I was selling for big and small companies throughout my career. You know, we were spending millions of dollars on paid databases. Mm-hmm. And I felt that I could never find the damn people that I needed to connect with. So when I was selling for IBM and Google, you know, just reached out to a lot of engineers in my network, and we built a search engine. Sergey Brin and his wife invested, and we built Seamless.ai to find anyone in the world. And then using an artificial intelligence engine, we research everyone's direct dials, and I used it to become a millionaire in sales. And then realized my life was forever changed. And I'm like, hey, I want to help everyone. I want everyone to win the seven-figure club award, which means you've generated $1 million in sales using what we built. And that's
yeah. So that's a contest you run through your website.
Yeah. It's really, I don't know if it's a contest, but more of like a lifetime
competition of sort.
Yeah. An achievement.
Well, tell us about it. So how's it work?
Oh yeah. So, we give out this like $1,000 award for the six-figure club, the seven-figure club, and the eight-figure club. So six-figure club means you've generated over $100,000 in sales using, you know, Seamless and the strategies and the platform. And then we ship out
in a specific period of time or
in a year. Okay. And then the seven-figure club means you've generated over $1 million in sales in a year. And then the eight-figure club is you've generated over $10 million in sales. And then my most coveted award, which I don't know who's won it or if someone's won it, but they've generated over $100 million in sales. I've got one client that did like $80 million that I can track. So it's
an individual or a company?
No, that's a team. That's
okay.
That's a
All team. Right. All right. As an individual, that'd be pretty impressive.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that'd be pretty epic. In a year. It's hard to do in a year.
I had 1 year bookings over 100.
Yeah.
So
I did it in total. I never did the 100 mil in a year, but yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah. Well, I was selling big, complex communications networks. It was not to say it was easier, but it wasn't software. So yeah. that part maybe was something a little bit different. So what was the impetus to go out on your own, though? I mean, was it just, hey, this is something that's working so great, I need to make sure the world sees it, or?
Yeah, a few things. I mean, you know, I'm a serial salesperson, entrepreneur, and gambler, I like to say, because, you know, been building companies since I was 18. First company I did was for the gambling industry.
Which is what?
Come again?
What did you do?
Oh, so I launched an affiliate marketing software platform for Party Poker, Full Tilt Poker, Poker Stars, and that did about $12 million in sales over the course of 3 years.
Wow.
And made a ton of money. But then, you know, I was super young, 18, 19, 20. So then they made online gambling illegal and I launched a second company. I thought text message marketing was going to be the future. And I was wrong. This was when there were flip phones. So I invested about $3 million, 3 years of my life. And it's funny, the partners 10 years ago when we did in mobile are now my partners now with Seamless. So, you know, we learned that we didn't know how to do B2B sales. And we learned, you know, you should listen to really smart people when you get advice.
Right.
And you need the list to sell your software to the list. And then I quit entrepreneurship and then, you know, just selling for B2B corporate. I just always had the pain points of, man, it's so painful to find everyone you need to sell to, build the list, get the emails, get the phone numbers, you name it. And all the sales databases were just terrible. So I kind of,
at least you had some.
Yeah, exactly. No, and we spent millions of dollars on these sales databases. Yeah. So it was awesome, but I would still spend 80% of my time prospecting, researching who the hell to sell to. That drove me nuts. And then I built Seamless as my own secret weapon. And so being an entrepreneur and a salesperson, right when I hit these different pillars, it was like, okay, I'm ready to do the entrepreneur thing for a third time. And knew that this was a massive, being the first case study, I knew anyone could do it if they had it. So kind of went all in and, you know, it's been a hell of a journey now with, I don't know, helping 150,000 salespeople, marketers, and entrepreneurs, thousands of people win the President's Club Awards, you know, our 6, 7, 8-figure club awards, and just want to positively impact a billion people.
Yeah. So how many people won those awards, you said?
So from what we can track, a few thousand. What we can't track, it's probably in the, you know, 5 to 10,000. You know, it's hard because the way that you have to self-report it. So like it was automatically reported. I bet you we'd see a shitload. So either way, though, changing the lives of thousands of people.
I think that's a good goal, is to set up a system where you can track all that.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, it's all attributable. If you research someone at a company and that closes a deal, boom, you know the number. So that's...
Yeah, because for me, part of the vision there is, we got to get to the point where we have a way to evaluate a seller that's verifiable, right? Mm-hmm. That if you're interviewing somebody and they said, look, I sold $2 million last year at this company and so on, we need to have a system that says, yeah, we can track that. We can show that that's true. So it's people just aren't...
I like that. Smoke. That's smart.
Because I think that the ultimate goal should be is, how do we develop like a credit score for an individual seller? There's a score they take with them that normalizes the variables across various industries and types of products and says, look, this person has a 680 score, and we know a 680 is good.
It's interesting.
And even though they come from different industries and they've sold different types of products. And then if you're hiring somebody, you don't have to say, well, I posted on this a few weeks ago on LinkedIn and got huge response about, everybody says, oh, we want to hire you, but you need SaaS experience. Like, right? You don't need SaaS experience. Everything. But this would be a way to sort of take people and have an understanding that, I understand the context. We've normalized the variables. We've leveled one out. And if somebody's got a certain score, I'd hire them.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you could have a high score and you cannot know how to pitch or close. I would say that's interesting. We test for positivity, coachability, doing whatever it takes. Like a score sometimes can't calculate that. Like,
But if you could.
Yeah, well, if you could, that'd be awesome. Like, there's different things you could do, right? But it'd be interesting.
Well, that's sort of the shortfall in sales hiring, right? Is it's still not driven by data very much. It's still, to your point, right? Is somebody coachable? That's still a feeling you have, that whether they're coachable. Yeah, you can sort of give them, do two rounds of interviews, or in the interview, have them do something, coach them, have them come back, do it again, presentation, whatever. But still, it's a subjective judgment.
Yeah, 100%.
Right? So how do we inject more objectivity into this process? That's why this idea that I love about the sales credit score is to eliminate some of that. So you have an easier time hiring, and it's less fraught with risk as it is now.
Mm. Yeah. No, it'd be interesting. I think the tricky part is like, how would you judge someone that's in high transaction software sales? Let's just say they close a ton of business, they crush their quota, right? But then maybe someone that's in highly personalized, low volume enterprise sales, they may judge that person is too aggressive or whatever. And then the other way around, you could judge the enterprise person for high transaction as not being able to overcome sales objections if their life depended on it. So, I think cross industry would be it'd be interesting.
Yeah. Well, I think I'm throwing it out to people as a challenge, because I think this is one of the next frontiers, if you will. Mm. I mean, think about it. So I imagine you've hired a bunch of people during the pandemic, right? People that you've never met personally, right?
Virtually we've met, but we've hired about 100 people.
In person, you've never met, you've never done the traditional. So, and I asked this question of a lot of sales leaders, you've hired a bunch of people. Mm-hmm. Did you factor into that their ability to work remotely and independently?
Yeah, for sure.
But a lot of people haven't, right? They sort of gone through the same hiring process as if they were hiring somebody that could be part of on a sales floor in a location. And it's like, well, okay, but it's a different situation we're entering now. I mean, I remember when I was
totally different
building offices out in Europe, and this was ages ago. And it was like, Yeah, we had to hire people specifically who we thought had this capability of being self-sufficient, being independent, being, self-sufficient. And it's funny, I talk to sales leaders now that it's like, well, do you screen for that? Well, no, because maybe they have this assumption that we're all going to come back and be working one place again or whatever. And it's like, hey, this is critical. Not everybody can do that.
Yeah. Now, I remember when all the venture capitalists, we pitched 347 VCs, 297 said no. And the majority of them said no because we were remote, because, we weren't in Silicon Valley, you knew it, just all this bullshit stuff. And now it's funny looking back, it's like we were all remote. Like from the onset of building our company, we figured out the distributed workforce. It's about the people. You find the game changers. You find the people that do whatever it takes, somehow judge and score that, right? Bring them on board, validate it. And then you could do anything. You do whatever it takes. You know, again, why put in the book.
Let's pitch the book, yes.
Oh, I know. And
no, I'm kidding. I'm just kidding. That's fine. That's part of the reason you're here.
Oh, say it again?
That's part of the reason we're talking.
Yeah, no.
It's okay to pitch your book.
Yeah, no. I wrote this because so many people were struggling with COVID and the pandemic and took all the habits from building a company during the financial crisis that was successful and that failed to two different companies, right? During the mortgage crisis. And then I just knew just from being an entrepreneur, being a serial salesperson, like everyone's going to underestimate the amount of shit that we're all going to go through during the pandemic, how we have to do 300, 500% more activity than what we had to do before to make the same pay, produce the same results, you name it. Like just the mindset, the habits that everyone needs to survive and thrive. And in 22 days, March, when they shut down Ohio, where I'm at right now, just wrote every morning for 2 hours, like what are all the habits that I've developed, I've taught myself, my team, everyone I know, people I mentor, you name it. And it's I don't know, tens of thousands of copies have sold, and it's
good.
Awesome. So
well, congratulations. So what is the number one habit?
Got to do whatever it takes.
Okay.
Number one habit, whatever it takes. So let's dive in. Like, what does that mean?
Yeah, break it down.
It means like, okay, so my day yesterday, and I didn't want to do any of this shit, but my day yesterday, it's like, hey, I got to go on a 2-hour customer coaching call to all of our customers because we host these like once or twice a week. Then I was on a 2-hour webinar presentation. Then I was on an hour podcast. Then I was on an hour investor call. Then I was on 2 hours of stand-ups across each department of the company. Like, I don't want to do any of those things at any given point in time. Right. But you just got to do whatever it takes to be successful, to serve your mission, to help whatever you're trying to achieve, right? To help the people that you're trying to achieve and impact. I think doing whatever it takes is just, whether it's calling, emailing, social selling, list building, studying, learning, reading, whatever it takes to go from where you're at today to where you need to go tomorrow to be successful, you got to do it. And I think too many people, we're in a society of excuses. I'd love to hear your take on this, Andy, but like the whole world's telling you to do less, to go easy, to be comfortable, to not push the boundaries, to not go all out, to not go all in. It will be okay. And like, you know, I fundamentally just challenge that, because anything great that I've seen anyone accomplish has put so much work, effort, so much tenacity, output, activity, insane amount of work ethic, goals to accomplish what they've accomplished, become the millionaires, the top 1% salespeople, you name it. And that's what it takes.
Yeah, well, the fact is that I agree. I mean, I've wrote about that in my first book addressing this idea that salespeople are reluctant to prospect. And I was like, well, it'd be an ideal world. It'd be great if you didn't have to.
Yeah,
but if you don't have a pipeline, right? you gotta go do what it takes, right? It's just, I agree with you. I don't know if the ethos has changed. I think some of it has with our specialized sales roles. In some cases, people have gotten sort of spoiled with, you know, hey, somebody's setting up meetings and appointments for me and so on.
Yeah.
But if they're not, what are you gonna do about it? I mean, I've told the story on the show many times about running the senior guy who people thought very highly of, and ran to him at a conference, and he was at a new gig, and he says, "You won't believe it. They want me to prospect."
And I'm like, "Oh,
dude, that's a problem for you." Yeah, I mean, I'm of a different generation than you, and coming up through entrepreneurial working for startups, where, yeah, my business was overseas mostly, and wow, we had no directories. I'd pick up the phone and cold call into Deutsche Telekom, and people didn't speak English, and try to find the right person.
That'd be tough.
You did what it took, right?
Yeah. What are those takes?
So I think that, yeah, I'm all in with you on that. And it's, yeah, too often I think we're wanting people to hand us things. If you're a seller, hand me training, hand me knowledge, hand me acumen. And these are all things that as an individual contributor, you have to invest in yourself to develop.
Yeah, 1,000%. Invest in the technology, the training, the skills. Don't wait for your employer to do it.
Like, well, they're not going to give it to you.
You know, your biggest asset is yourself and your ability to improve. You know, if you don't improve every day or every week, every day, I like to say every day, like one of the habits is you have to improve, work to improve 1% every day minimum.
Yeah, me too. I have the same thing. Just the aggregation of marginal gains, they call it.
100%.
Yeah, just keep trying to get a little bit better. And one of the easiest ways to do that for sellers, and that sort of escapes them, is to have more conversations with buyers, ask better questions, and really listen to understand. Get away from the script. Make sure you don't leave a call until you really understand, confirm you understand exactly what the buyer, their concern is, the particular problem, you know, whatever aspect of it is you're dealing with, because that's how you learn. Mm-hmm. It's not going to come from training from the company. Right. I mean, I ask people all the time, I'll ask you, so who taught you how to sell?
Shit. At the beginning?
Whatever. I mean, throughout your career.
My dad sold for CA, and it was the first company to do $1 billion in software sales, and
yep,
they took that public. So for me, I got to learn from my dad. But then my professional career at the beginning, no one. So I, like when I wrote this book, Sales Secrets, and we got to interview you for your top sales secret, Andy.
Oh, sure. Love to.
I've learned from reading all the sales books. So I invested like a decade studying and reading all the sales books to look for the secrets. But it took me hundreds of books, 10 years. And over time, I just kept on improving. And then I would invest in my own training, mastermind, coaching, you name it. It was a multiplier effect. You just keep getting better and better, and you keep increasing your income and your revenue results to an insane amount, you know, multiplier.
Yeah. I mean, I certainly did all that. I read as many things. There weren't as many sales books at that time, but there were still some. But I mean, some of the classics, Zig Ziglar and Earl Nightingale and people like that. But I learned really from my customers. Yeah, my first job out of college, I was selling computer systems at the time that cost $60,000 to $250,000, so $1 million plus these days. And for accounting applications, so I signed a construction company, a lot of construction companies at the time. This is up in Oakland in the Bay Area.
Wow.
And just sat, listened to entrepreneurs tell me about their business, right? I was dealing with the CEOs and the business owners, and they taught me how to sell them. Right, they taught me what was important in their business, the things they were looking for, and if you asked the questions, just paid attention. Yeah, I always tell people I learn mostly from my customers. I had a couple key mentors in there as well.
Yeah, I think that's smart. We had a big coaching call this morning, and it's like to your point about discovery. When someone throws something out at you, question, objection, Q&A, whatever, like keep digging. If you don't get it or don't understand, like, keep asking more and more questions to understand. Don't leave that call like, oh, well, now I don't know where we're going with this.
Exactly. And unfortunately, I think that too often now in the way that we train sellers is, yeah, not to lean on this cliche too much, a little bit too scripted. They're too anxious to get to the next question. and this value of understanding mm-hmm. is lost on many of them.
Yeah. And you got to be curious.
Well, you're curious, but you have to understand, right? It's not enough to ask a question if you don't take the time to really understand the answer. And yeah, I've coached people on this. One of the simple things coach people do is just pause before you respond, right? Take a beat, one Mississippi, or whatever way you want to count it, and give yourself time to think before mm-hmm. you respond. You can be very excited and you want to say, yeah, I've got this nailed. I've got the answer. Just take a breath. Think about it. Gather your thoughts.
That's why I love the mute button.
Like, go ahead. Explain that.
Oh, well, being on calls, I love the mute button. And like the power of just muting yourself and taking notes, intently listening, laser focused on the needs, the wants, the desires, the biggest pains of your prospects. Like, dude, the mute button's one of the most powerful buttons that you could press. And then I also think the record button is also one of the most powerful buttons you could press for watching game film.
And do you do that frequently?
Yeah, we try to record, analyze, and learn and optimize everything, you know, from everything in sales and then shit, even outside of sales. I think we produce like, I don't know, 1 to 4 hours of content a day. So like we're real time recording everything in sales and outside of sales to just keep learning, keep improving. All the top athletes, they all do that. And we just follow it.
So to that point, do you record job interviews?
Yes, we do. It depends on what line, like depends on the line that you're on, right?
Yeah, but let's say
some HR, like some people don't have auto like Zoom recording. Mm-hmm. My line's always auto recorded. So I record them every interview I'm on. Do I analyze the interview after?
Yeah.
I haven't analyzed an interview after, actually. What about you?
I don't do a lot of hiring these days. I haven't for a number of years, or pre-Zoom. So, but I urge people to. Mm. I mean, it's like everything. It's like if you don't get feedback, how do you get better at it?
Yeah. It's a good question.
And, you know, sales interviewing typically is pretty horrible and not very modern these days. There's lots of modern ways to interview that people aren't using.
Why do you say it's terrible?
Because for most companies, they don't try to take a data-based approach to hiring. I mean, simple things is, you know, obviously some companies are doing scorecards, right? We've got, here are 6 criteria that are key. We're going to score somebody from 1 to 5. That's a simple way to do it. And then say, look, for somebody to qualify to be hired, they have to have a certain minimum score, right? Mm-hmm. And then they track that, see the people with certain scores, how they performed. And then they go back and perhaps revamp their hiring criteria. Right. That's just a really simple way to do it. But
super subjective too, right? Like,
yeah, who goes back and says, look, we're going to analyze how these hires did based on objective criteria that we were able to surface during the interview process.
Yeah.
Because if you don't do that, you know, there's been some studies that show that shit, just hire off the resume. Don't even interview them. And you'll be just as predictive of success as actually talking to someone.
Interesting. You know what we do? We have them pitch us.
Mm-hmm.
So
pitch themselves?
No, I have them pitch us, our company, to us.
Oh, okay. All right.
We literally will say, like, do your research. You're pitching mm-hmm. us. I'm the VP of sales. Now I don't do the sales interviewing anymore. Now that we're up to, you know, 80 people in the sales division, I've got a VP of inside sales and a VP of sales that do that. But, you know, we have the AEs pitch us, mm-hmm. second interview. We have the SDRs literally prospect live with us in the interview.
It's good.
Here's the scripts, go. And you could learn a lot about people. How are they scared of the phone? Are they scared of prospecting? Right. How do they do with objections? The pitch, like you can really understand critical thinking, strategy, prep, you name mm-hmm. it. And the way that different people act and engage. Like that was probably the biggest game changer for us when it came to hiring.
To start doing that.
To do that. Now, yeah. It's very difficult to understand, can someone close? Like closing big multi-million dollar deals, $100,000 deals, $10,000 deals, $5,000 deals, like closing and objection handling on the A front, I think is a critical skill that you have to have. And testing for that, you could do role-playing and objection handling and whatnot. I think sure. You look at historical performance plus, you know, like doing it live with them.
Well, so let me ask a question, because this is sort of a point with me, is if you had to say somebody's a closer or the closing skills, What is that? Let me tell you why I ask, because I don't want to seem like a gotcha question or something, but in my career, personally, probably closed 2/3 of $1 billion in orders.
It's awesome.
I was never in the room when they made the decision. So it wasn't like I was doing a close, right? So I think too often people take this idea of a closer as somebody who's, you know, I'm here. We're not leaving this room until you sign the agreement, which in complex B2B is just not the case, right?
Right.
So in your mind, what are those skills that you call as closing skills?
Yeah, deep sales discovery, right? Really digging hard and deep to understand who are the key decision makers? What are the biggest problems? What are the biggest pain points? The biggest desires? What's the transformation and results that you need to sell? Like that the company's trying to solve for, right? And, and hopefully your solution can overcome. How are those decisions made? Who makes those decisions? How, what, where, what would kill those decisions? Timeline, you know, authority, budget, need, all of these things are like digging deep on sales discovery on the front of it.
Yep.
Being able to present your solution to take them from where they're at today to where they want to go tomorrow, biggest pains and biggest desires. And then understanding and digging deep at the end of that type of pitch presentation or multi-pitch discussion, what would hold the deal back? What are the questions? What are the concerns? And like, if they're not giving them to you, really pushing the prospect to uncover like what is holding them back, if anything, from moving forward with what you, this problem solution, this program, product, whatever it is that you put together. It's hard to do, right? Like the top salespeople in the world do it. And it's hard to test for in an interview.
Yeah, because everybody does it differently. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, I don't think there's a single model that applies to everyone. But I think, I think you summed it up well. I mean, and this is a part that, again, part of what drives me nuts is people think about closing as a specific action as opposed to a process, right? That is really just part of being a top seller.
I think it's like solving the problem, but then like really understanding what would stop you and the prospect from working together to solve the problem. And I think a lot of people are scared to ask the tough questions or really uncover the things that would kill the opportunity or slow down the opportunity.
Or make it accelerate. See, I've always, beyond a certain point of experience in my career, is uncovered this fact that at least for me is that all those things you said apply. But I found is that in every instance, certainly in complex sales, there's always one thing that's more important than all the others. And what I found is the top sellers were really better at uncovering that one thing. Because there's one thing that somebody in a position of authority or power cares about more than everything else. And if you can orient what you're doing, your pitch, your solutions, options, all everything to that, to solve that problem, your odds of winning go up substantially.
Even if you 100% agree.
Even if you, I mean, I'll give you an example. We had bidding on this one deal in Asia, and they were wanting to be one of the first cruise lines to have broadband internet connections. Wow. This was a little bit ago, and they went voice over IP in the staterooms and so on. And as it turned out, you know, we got an RFP that had like a a 300 line item compliance matrix that we had to fill out.
Yep. I remember working on those.
And I told the seller on the deal, I said, look, these are not all equally important. You know, you haven't found the one thing yet. And so he goes back and he had developed a good relationship with the CEO of this cruise line. And he said, yeah, found the one thing. Only thing he cares about is, the broadband internet, that's great. You know, voice RP from the stateroom's fantastic. What he cares about, though, is minute by minute update on the take from the onboard casinos. So what we did is completely restructured the proposal. We didn't ignore, but we didn't emphasize.
Was that like a profit center for them? Why did he care so much about that?
Yeah, you think? And so it was all the profit. So yeah, we doubled down on the reliability of that link to make sure it never went down. You know, hot backup everything, didn't matter where at sea they were and so on. And that we focused the entire proposal just on that. We led with that. And that would have been buried, right, in the RFP. And if we hadn't dug deep, we hadn't asked, we hadn't uncovered that one thing, we wouldn't have won. So I think that, that's what top sellers, in addition to the things you mentioned, is really good as. There is always one thing.
Yep.
And if you uncover it, that's the key to the door.
Yeah, I agree. For us, like, you know, you just saying that, I'm thinking about, hey, my one thing and shit, I talk about it every day of the week. Maybe even every hour at the company is just our MRR and ARR growth. Mm-hmm. You know, like we're hyperscaling to a 9-figure business and I'm obsessed with MRR and ARR growth. So you come to me with a solution. I'll give you an example of a solution that this didn't happen. No disrespect to them, but you know, these companies were trying to sell conversation intelligence, right? Where they record your calls. And then they coach you or whatever.
Yeah, we sell one of those.
Yeah, no, totally. And this isn't Andy's solution, by the way. Yeah. But they just kept tying it to like, oh, you'll be able to coach up the reps, and you'll be able to do this, you'll be able to transcribe, and all the stuff, right? All the bullshit I don't care about. Right. If they were like, hey, Brandon, we're going to take Seamless from multiple 8 figures to hitting the 9-figure number in X timeline.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why instant sale. They kept coming back, all of them, like all these different parties, just pitching, presenting the bullshit.
They're pitching a product, not a solution.
Yeah. Like my one thing, MRR, ARR growth. And granted, I've literally got 7 screens here.
I saw a video.
All these dashboards. So I watch a number of KPIs, but there's one that I care the most about, and that would be that.
Yeah, I got screen envy after I saw a little video clip of you with all your screens. It's like, I've only got 2. What's wrong? Actually, I've got 3. I've got my iPad down here. It's got all my questions on the iPad. So
there you go.
Yeah, I'm a piker. I got 3 more to go. So I'll work on it. So I'm trying to think of the time we have left. So many things I want to ask. So let's dig into this. So has sales technology helped sellers become more productive?
Yeah, 100%. I mean,
so how do you define productivity?
Sales velocity, increase in sales results, is what I would say. I would like, has sales technology helped us to generate more sales than we could without it? Right. When you've got a platform like Seamless, where you've got reps spending half a day or 75% of their day every day building lists, looking for people to sell to, how to contact them, right? You know, okay, now we can automate it in seconds. Mm-hmm. When you've got calling technology that will allow you to take that list, you know, you leverage a Ring DNA or something like that, and boom, you can connect with every single person faster than ever before versus manually dialing or recording, you know, email technology, the LinkedIn messaging technology. I would say, it definitely accelerates sales, right? If you look at the GDP and just the growth of the economy, right, as technology scaled, definitely has.
Well, but that's an interesting point because, Paul, and I bring this up for a reason because, Paul Krugman wrote, I think it's back in the fall, Nobel Prize winning economist, saying that basically productivity growth has slumped basically since the turn of the century. That we got our investments out of, it basically boils down to the things that were transformed from a technology standpoint for personal productivity were the PC, email, and broadband. And since then, the economy, productivity growth in the economy has basically been flat fairly much. So, and I presume sales isn't immune from that. But I just wonder, I ask the question because I feel like we don't use the technology appropriately. And my sense is from talking to a lot of companies is that I define productivity as revenue per hour of sales time generated.
Yeah, very similar.
And on, right? And on that basis, I don't see anything that's convinced me that it's gotten better over the last 20 years.
I think it depends on probably the industry, the company, a number of different facets, right? I don't know. Like, I couldn't imagine selling 10 years ago versus now. I couldn't imagine, 10 years from now, I'll be like, I can't believe we sold the way that we did 10 years ago now. So,
But let me ask you a question though. Mm-hmm. So this is it's sort of leading from one point to another. So you can't imagine selling the way we did 10 years ago, imagine 40 years ago. But it's interesting, when I obviously read a lot about sales process and talk to a lot of people about sales process. So when I have people lay out the steps of their sales process, and I go, same sales process we used 40 years ago. Steps are all the same. Mm-hmm. We've automated some of them, but the steps are all the same.
Yep.
It's like, we have this whole thing going around about, modern sales. And it's like, it doesn't really seem too modern, right? We put the veneer of technology on it, but it seems like we haven't crossed the chasm to say, look, how do we use this technology to help people be more effective in front of the prospect so that for every hour of sales time they have, they're actually generating more revenue?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's where you've got all of this amazing sales automation technology, right? Like, that's why we built Seamless to automate all of everything pre-appointment when it comes to the data. The emailing, you've got, what I also think is all the data on people and companies. I mean, there's so much data about people and companies now where you could be hyper relevant and personalized to the niche with your pitch. That would be very difficult to do without LinkedIn, Google, you name it. So I would say, the technology is out there and it's making everything smarter, better, faster. But I guess it depends on who you talk to.
Yeah. Well, I think it can. And this is,
I'm optimistic. This is really,
clearly, and I am too. I just think, I feel like we're stuck.
Why do you think we're stuck?
Because I look at various data points, right? CSO Insights, it's relatively minor percentage of sellers making quota year over year. Mm-hmm. 50% or less. We've got win rates in SaaS that are down. The most qualified opportunities down below 20% or 20%. We've got just these indicators saying we're not getting better at the selling part. We're getting fantastic at top of the funnel. And we're using the technology to great effect there. But once it actually gets into what I call selling, because I don't consider that selling. Once we get into the actual selling motions,
like the meeting and post demo and post
discovery, qualification, needs analysis, all of our things, we haven't gotten any better at that. It seems like we should be able to. And you're talking about, meeting preparation, that's one element of it that's hugely important because reps don't prepare sufficiently. They're not learning enough. They're not engaged in sort of the self-development you talked about. And there's all these things that are part of the puzzle. But we haven't found a way to really put it together. And that's why I feel like we're stuck. We're using these antiquated processes that we've automated. And we're still seller focused in the way we approach the customer. It's about our process, not their process. Sales managers aren't trained how to manage, not trained how to coach. We've got all these huge gaps that present opportunities, but we don't seem to have the will to close them.
Yeah. I think it depends on the company. You know, we wrote 15 books, recorded over hundreds of hours of training material for everything from discovery to pitching to closing to objection handling, Q&A to cold emailing, social selling, list building, picking a niche, script writing. So like we do, I can't relate to the people that don't do whatever it takes, but like we do whatever it takes to develop all the training, the coaching, the learning, the education. And it could be why we've been able to grow so fast, but
yeah,
I feel bad for anyone at a company that where they're not doing that.
Unfortunately, it's most of them.
Yeah. Why do you think that is? Like as a CEO and a salesperson, I couldn't imagine like being in an environment. And to be honest, when I sold for IBM and a resource, like this is how they were. It was nothing. I'm giving you nothing. You're here. Go make millions of dollars in sales. And I hated that. So I think I've been in the bad and the good. And that's why I built everything that we built.
Yeah, it's probably, I'm similar. I mean, I had 8 weeks of training my first year on the job in 1977 and nothing since. So everything was on me.
Yeah.
And I think we touched on it earlier. I think that's sort of unfortunate that companies are willing to do sort of the minimum to try to equip and enable their salespeople and especially their sales managers. I mean, that's, you know, to me is the shame, right? Here's this resource that could be so influential in the lives of sellers. And we are talking as an industry and profession, we do so little to develop them. And yeah, how many sales managers get trained on how to be an effective coach? Mm-hmm. How many sales managers are coached in being an effective coach?
Yeah.
Why aren't we having specialized coaches? You know, why doesn't a sales team invest in, let's have a coach who's just an expert on objection handling or who's expert in qualification or putting together business cases? Why do they have to be a manager? Why can't we have this layer of coaches? So there's lots of things we could do that just people aren't thinking about because it's like, yeah, we'll just sort of make our usual investment. Let's keep our SG&A below a certain percentage. And we did our bit.
That's like buying a bunch of Ferraris, keeping them in the garage and never fueling them up to hit the streets. Salespeople are the game changers, the pioneers, the people making it
exactly
to survive and thrive. And I do whatever it takes to make sure that they've got everything that they could possibly need to keep expanding and growing. Companies die because they don't have sales, you know? I agree with you that all companies should go all in on making sure that every part of the funnel, like the salespeople, are always trained every day. Every day you should be training.
Yep.
Daily stand-ups, daily coaching sessions. If you could do daily call review, that'd be huge. Like so much stuff.
Sure. But even you go beyond that is instead of bringing in an outside sales trainer you're going to spend a bunch of money on and spend half a day and then people go away and forget it, give your people stipends, right? Make it part of their development plan, make it part of their compensation plan. Is, look, we're going to give you a stipend for using outside training resources that we've vetted, right? Here's a list of 20 of them. Go do it, and we're going to hold you accountable for taking them.
Yeah, I love that.
And doing it every day.
100%.
And that's one other conversation. I think another one we can have is, I think we should tie compensation to people's rate of improvement.
That would be awesome. I mean, you kind of probably do, right? Because eventually, if you stay stagnant, you're going to be gone. Because everyone you hope is constantly improving and getting better. Not hope.
Yeah. If they don't, I mean, as a basic metric, right? I tell people is you have to change. Your personal rate of change has to at least meet the rate of change of the world around you.
Yeah.
And it's not, then you're making the decision to fall behind.
Yeah. Eventually you will get left behind for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I just don't let people that aren't improving or obsessed with improvement around me, our circle, our company, because that will eventually negatively hold me back and the people around us. So it's like, if you're not obsessed with improvement, optimization, learning, training, coaching, improving, man, I don't want you in my network, let alone my company.
I love the attitude. Love it. All right, well, Brandon, we've run out of time, but it's been great.
Yeah. Dude, you brought some really interesting things to the conversation today that I haven't really gotten a lot of time to think about recently. So I appreciate that, Andy.
Well, think about it. Come back. We'll talk about them some more.
Yeah, that was awesome. The credit score thing for salespeople is interesting. I'm just trying to figure out statistically how you would make it like unbiased and applicable across any industry.
Right.
That's the tricky part.
All right, we'll figure that part out. So if people want to contact you.
Oh, LinkedIn.
LinkedIn.
Hit me up on LinkedIn. Also, I've got a daily newsletter at seamless.ai. Join Seamless for free. You'll get my daily script strategies, secrets that I post there, as well as you'll be able to find emails and direct dials for anyone in the world in seconds for free. So check it out and look forward to
hearing from you. All right, Brandon, thank you so much.
Andy, thanks so much for having me on the show today. Appreciate you. Congrats.
Okay, friends, that's it for this episode. First of all, I want to thank you for taking the time to listen. As always, we're so grateful for your support of the show. And I want to thank my guest, Brandon Bernanson, for sharing his insights with us today. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to this podcast, Sales Enablement with Andy Paul, on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you could also leave us a rating or a review and let us know how we're doing, we'd appreciate it. You can do all that on your phone in less than a minute as soon as this episode is over. So thank you for your help. And as always, thank you so much for investing your time with me today. Until next time, I'm your host, Andy Paul. Good selling, everyone.
Hey, sales strategists. At Revenue.io, we're not just imagining the future of sales, we're building it. We offer the world's most complete platform for revenue teams, and we're featured in the most recent Forrester Waves for both sales engagement and conversation intelligence. With Revenue.io, you can slash call prep time to seconds, guide your reps in real time to have more successful conversations, and after calls, we generate ready-to-send recap emails so sellers can keep deals soaring toward the finish line at light speed. See the future of sales now at Revenue.io.